This week's episode is brought to you by Dracomega and Zane Silvius. Thank you, Dracomega and Zane Silvius. It's with the generous support of listeners like you that we get to keep slapping down strange discussions to confuse your friends and horrify your family every single week. If you'd like to walk upon the same red carpet as our illustrious supporters, please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 gets you access to not only our entire library of extended episodes, but a 5x5 vinyl sticker of our cover art, and clandestine access to our Discord server, where we discuss how if Finding Nemo were scientifically accurate, then Marlin would have changed sexes to reproduce with his son, but he sort of does that in his weird spiritual developmental sense anyway. If you're the curious sort and would like to see the voluminous show notes, then our $10 tier is for you. But if you like the show and you'd rather spend your money on jelly beans, please subscribe, comment, share, and review the show. It actually helps quite a bit. This week's episode sees us talking about the esoteric language of the body and how to decode its secrets, like when it's aroused, terrified, or lying, using tricks developed by the FBI. We also glimpse the ancient past to discover the origin of interpreting body language and how the heart may not be a pump at all. In the extended show, we discuss CIA remote viewing, Kujikiri hand gesture, and the ritual poses of hermetic tradition. Thank you, and enjoy the show. Mercury in the Gatorade once more.
Gatorade.
It's crazy, like how the food chain for animals, like dolphins have a load of mercury or heavy metals in their system because they eat a lot of fish. Like the fish have less mercury, but then like a dolphin eats like 100 of those fishes a day. So then its body just goes up and up and up. So that like the microorganisms in the sea have some metal in them, but then it's like up at the top of the food chain, it's just horrible.
Apparently there's like a lot of radioactive tuna out there.
You think you could pick up a dolphin with a magnet, a big enough magnet?
I don't know. I think that depends on the dolphin's preferences. I think if they're really into magnets, you could probably pick one up.
Magnets, how do they work?
Well, you have to read their body language.
I don't think you want to know how magnets work.
What's a magnet pickup line?
You're so negative.
Hey, baby dolphin, is that mercury in your system, or are you naturally drawn to me?
Baby dolphin. Lol.
I'm baby dolphin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just analyze the subtle minutiae of nerves, fluid pockets, and muscles that compose your deliciously expressive face meats in pursuit of your precious micro-expressions so that we can better program your smartphone to manipulate you. Oh, no! We bring you in for questioning on your day off so you can subconsciously participate in your own humiliation. We know you killed your boyfriend in the lobby with the chandelier, but Colonel Mustard is looking a little guilty too, because this week we're discussing the secrets of body language. I'm your host, Luke Madrid, the Hack Rabbit. I'm joined this week by the girl who lets her tail wag indiscriminately, Marisama.
Or rather, my corgi butt wag. Lack of tail.
He's wrinkling his nose because he's allergic to your bullshit. Malachor 5.
What's up? I just dropped an electric guitar on my foot.
Ouch.
The hottie of heart squishes and tummy butterflies. Hecka Astra.
Oh, sweet.
Oh, goddamn. My body language right now is the symbol of f***ing pain.
You really dropped an electric guitar on your foot?
Yeah. Oh. Slipped out my hand as I tried moving it and right onto my bare foot.
I thought you just always held an electric guitar for host intros.
I did, but I had to put it down to say hi. I'll live.
As long as you don't put any on my pizza.
Guitars or toes?
Olives.
I get it.
Surprise, this episode we're just exploring the symbolism in Nicolas Cage and Val Kilmer's Face-Off. You didn't know?
I've never seen that movie.
It's Nicolas Cage and John Travolta, though.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Look, I'm from the other timeline, okay?
Oh, that makes sense then. That's fine.
I'm from the timeline where Sinbad was a genie in a movie. For real.
That sounds so familiar.
Yeah, but it technically didn't ever happen. Like the Shaq one was a ripoff. Okay, no, the episode really is about body language. What is body language? The process of communicating non-verbally through conscious or unconscious gestures and movements. One thing that makes body language so fascinating is that everybody uses it and understands how to read it, at least to some extent. Some listeners might not be surprised to hear that somewhere between 55 and 93% of in-person conversations occur non-verbally. These percentages were the famous result of two studies performed by a researcher named Albert Mehrabian in 1967, who found that linguistic content of a message, or the words being used, accounted for a mere insignificant 7% of the total connotative meaning of a message, leaving 38% for tone of voice and the other 55% for posture and body movement. This is why we have emojis.
So pretty much like the words themselves don't really matter.
Not really. Not when other signals are telling you something entirely different.
Oh, like if you say, oh, that looks super nice, but you're like frowning or you're rolling your eyes or something, that tells you that it means the opposite.
I used to really dislike emojis, and then I realized how necessary they are, especially if you speak very bluntly in a text format. I realize it's really easy to be misunderstood when you speak very bluntly and they can't see.
You laughing or smiling.
Yeah. Yeah.
I prefer emoticons.
That's what they used to be called, right?
No, emoticons are when you use text, like glyphs in text, to represent what face you're making. So emojis replace them because then that we could load pictures into the text stream.
Yeah.
Oh.
I made some custom ones too. I did like a lamb face for this girl I used to like.
Yeah, you can make up your own, like using creativity, which is why I liked those. There's the Japanese ones that are all intricate. Like
I like those.
People flipping tables and stuff. It's crazy. And don't forget uwu.
That reminds me a little bit of Mayan hieroglyphs, where they have tone of voice included in the hieroglyph depending on how the hieroglyph is drawn. It can change the tone and its inferred meaning. So in a way, emoticons and emojis are just reclaiming our ancient hieroglyphic heritage, man. Yep.
I like that.
I do too, because language started out as pictograms anyway. It only makes sense, you know, to use them to convey emotion as well.
I think it goes even farther back into time with like sacred geometry and stuff, and that those can be looked at as symbols. We might get into that later.
Well, the ancients knew about the importance of body language, about the importance of tone and gesture.
I mean, we probably had more communication going on with bodies long before we had an actual verbal language.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's even how animals communicate, is usually guttural grunts and squeaks and shrieks to convey what they're feeling and what they're trying to communicate. And there's no syntax or grammar.
I mean, sometimes it's pretty obvious. They just stick their butt in the air. I think we all know what that means.
Or they arch their back, which means fuck off.
So in ancient Rome, the famous orator Quintilian once said, "All emotional appeals necessarily lose their force if they're not kindled by the voice, facial expression, and demeanor of practically the entire body." Quintilian, born 30 AD, besides having the fanciest name in history, was a prodigal figure in ancient Rome, with Vespasian appointing him the chair of rhetoric over the fledgling empire. This might sound a little bit silly to us, but that's only because we're a fish being told about water. Quintilian's life's work was known as the Institutio Oratio, which, besides outlining and updating the five canons or tenets of rhetoric, invention, the process of developing arguments, arrangement, organizing the arguments for extreme effect, style, determining how to present the arguments, memory, the process of learning and memorizing the speech and persuasive messages, delivery, the gestures, pronunciation, tone, and pace used when presenting arguments, and how to raise a child to master these skills to become, quote, the perfect orator. In fact, many of Quintilian's ideas were building upon those popularized by Cicero, famous Roman statesman, historian, philosopher, skeptic, and of course, rhetorician. Cicero argued that to be a good orator, one must not only possess a good reputation, but be knowledgeable about every possible school of human thought and be able to speak readily on them in an intelligible, compelling, and satisfying way. This concept was termed liberal humanism and is largely responsible for where we got the idea of a liberal society and an educated citizenry that's able to communicate their ideas for profit and fun. This idea is so central to us now that it's baked into our language with phrases like upstanding citizen, putting your best foot forward, and holding yourself with dignity. Could anyone here survive a proper dinner with full English or European etiquette? I know I couldn't.
Nope.
Nah.
I think the way that I cut a steak is probably a huge no-no.
I like learning these things. I like being able to practice them. I feel like there are benefits to it.
I imagine it'd be kind of fun if you knew all the things and were good at it, but I think for me, I just like cut into the tri-tip.
We can have this really cool dynamic of eating at a table and other people are using their hands to put things on your plate. So like there's food going in everybody's mouth, but it's like from a different hand maybe.
In Rhetoric, Before and Beyond the Greeks, William Hollow argues that the art of rhetoric originated in ancient Mesopotamia in cuneiform literature. For instance, Hollow argues that the Epic of Gilgamesh employs rhetorical devices such as self-introduction of the speaker, invitation to the audience, hymnic apostrophe to the protagonist, repetition of the thesis to achieve a frame effect, and the extraneous addition of an addendum to reach a preferred length. Very 2020. Enhe Duana, sometimes heralded as the first named author in history, was a priestess, princess, poet, and consummate rhetorician who wrote over 4,000 years ago in ancient Sumeria. Modern historians note the exaltation of Inanna includes careful organized arguments, repetition, and use of metonymy, which is referring to something by what it's associated with.
That's like using the word in the definition of the word, right?
Is this like referring to a forest by the trees?
Yes.
It's kind of a funny word, first of all, and it means something kind of funny.
Like if you refer to a man as a mountain or a mountain as a man, he is the Gibraltar of the Winnie Pooh Pooh River. I don't know. Like that. And Enhe Duana explains her process of invention and moves between first and third person to relate her composing process in collaboration with the goddess Inanna. She also draws upon a cosmic audience to bear witness to her mystical arguments and poetic deductions. Then, over in ancient Egypt, the rules for governing good speech, which included not speaking, were governed by Ma'at, the cosmic principle or neter of justice and right action.
Netert.
That's singular.
That's singular feminine.
Thank you.
The single woman. What?
So, while we like to imagine the Greeks and Romans as the progenitor of the rhetorical arts, like everything else we've studied on this show, they picked it up from a much older source. One obscure example is the art of chironomia, which is the traditional and effective use of hand gestures in rhetoric and oratory. Although these various hand gestures were meticulously systemized by the Romans and Greeks, they are known to originate from older sources like Egypt and Mesopotamia, where these gestures were known to have certain effects over their audience. Modern science now understands that when a thought is formed, in order to reach the voice box, the signal must first cross the center that controls our hands.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Whoa, I'd say chironomia, the hand transcends its function because it's able to speak in its own right. Like it gains a new ability that's like kind of made up on top of its normal function.
Would this be different than with cultural influences as well?
Most likely, yeah.
Yes, I'd say so.
I tend to think of when the subject of like speaking with your hands comes up, I tend to think of like how Italians are very
punctuated.
they use their hands a lot when they're speaking.
That's a great example. If you've ever watched HBO's Rome, which is as historically accurate as you'd want a TV show to be, they show how important the orator's job was. The guy who reads the news in the center of town. He has to know how to project his voice very loud. But you don't have a camera that's like zoomed in on you with perfect makeup and lighting. You're in the middle of a town square, and part of conveying your message effectively is using your hand gestures, using your whole body. This is exactly what Quintilian was talking about.
Yeah, like if you miss a certain word because he's too far away, you can just see what his hands are doing. You kind of fill in the blank there.
Absolutely.
So the hands act as a kind of emphasis on what you're saying.
I see in my head an opera singer with her arm up. Like she needs her arm up like that. So they do it on purpose. Like
she can project her voice more with that arm extended.
You know, that's an iconic image you'll see even on logos and stuff.
I think you're right, Mari. It opens up the lungs more.
And it shows where you're projecting your voice. You're projecting it into the air. So you turn your head up and you hold your hand up as if you're guiding the sound.
That reminds me of like in basketball when you throw the ball and your hand still stays up in that direction. Or like if you're golfing, you don't like immediately after you take a swing, you don't immediately take it back down. It kind of stays up to like in that direction, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As if you're pushing it. Kind of like when I bowl, I do the same thing where I'm like, come on, I'm going to try to push you into the center of the lane.
And, you know, I don't know if we're going to talk about sports at all, but referees use a lot of different hand movements and body movements to communicate without words.
Because it's so loud and usually they only have a whistle in their mouth, not a microphone.
Well, it makes sense that rappers use their hands so much when they rap. People are even encouraged when they're learning how to rap for the first time to not be discouraged to use their hands because it helps them supposedly keep rhythm. But now we know through neuroscience that those very quick messages, especially if you're freestyling, they move through the circuits that control your hands first. So you ought to move them. It helps the entire thing happen.
And happen quicker and more efficiently.
So what are some practical uses of understanding body language? I think the one that people are most interested in is how to detect lies and sense the truth.
That's like our whole function as a spiritual being, right? Find the truth.
Truth detector.
Well, that's why everyone loves a good police story. So,
Especially the cops.
Well, as it turns out, 80% of crimes are solved through confession.
Why don't you have a seat over there?
Let's talk about this for a little bit. So police use this to discover who's innocent and who's guilty. Sometimes they also use it just to make somebody guilty, if we're being honest. But the good ones use it to figure out who the real guilty people are, right? Parents use it if they want to know if their kid's full of shit. Employers use it during a job interview. Are you able to show up on time? Do you have a machine that can get you to this job? If you work in the medical profession, it's helpful to know if your patient's lying to you about what drugs they've taken or if they've taken them. Like, you could just kill someone if you don't pick up on your patient lying because they're freaked out for no reason. Like, a lot of the time people will lie when they go to the hospital about what drugs they took, and this can lead to their harm, you know? And then if you're in the military, sometimes you have to make decisions very quickly about, like, is this person a danger that's approaching me? Like, are they secretly armed, or do they have some sort of an explosive device? And then if you're on a jury, is Amber Heard a giant-sized or what? Like,
no, she's a giant-sized duke.
The jury said yes, unanimously to that.
So those are all the places you really could benefit from knowing when somebody's lying. You can also read body language to sense when somebody's a threat.
Like when a homeless dude comes up and tries to ask for some food, and they try to lead you somewhere else, and you're like, nah, man. Nah. Like, it could be a trap.
Well, the funny thing about body language is that even when you're trained to hide it, people, that's speaking. You're speaking volumes already. Like, people can tell you that, like, oh, he's hiding.
He's like, covering something up and stifling it.
There's no way around it. Like you're always talking. Like, I guess that's why, like, with police especially, like, don't say anything to them without a lawyer because you're already giving them something.
Yeah, some ammo.
So just calm down and hide it.
But being able to assess if somebody's a threat is useful if you're going on a date or just being a woman in general.
Or a man.
Yeah, I work at a liquor store. Constantly have to have that radar on.
Or if you're passing strangers on the street, it's always important when you have an interaction with someone you don't know, you're going to be looking at their body language.
I think we pick up on a lot more subconsciously, too, than we do consciously. Like, it's so ingrained in us, whether someone is going to be threatening or not. I think there's micro expressions and like little things that we don't know why they're a threat, but we feel like they're a threat.
And we'll get into why you need to trust those feelings. If you drive,
you can even
go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, like, even if someone's slumped over and they're not feeling well, or they, you know, they have a pallid face, you can tell if people are sick or if they're not, you know, good to be around. Also, if you have your guy for your weed and you go to him all the time, and sometimes you have to find somebody else because he's on vacation, you're going to be judging that person as well. Like, if you don't know somebody personally already and you don't know how they're going to act, all you're going to be doing is focusing on their body language.
And them with you, too, in that scenario, you know?
Yeah, so you get hyper vigilant about how you're acting as well. So it's all about an act. It's like dancing almost when you first meet somebody.
You try and sell some weed and Mari just robs you?
No, yeah. It would be the other way around.
See a corgi running down the street with a big old bag of weed?
I never have done that. Don't tarnish my name.
In a 1911.
Like, first impressions, you know how people talk about first impressions a lot? Mm-hmm. There's only a certain amount of that that's based on a verbal interaction, right?
Absolutely.
Just 7%, I guess.
Yeah.
I remember one time my friend came over to my house to hang out with me, and he was a guy in high school. And so my dad took one look at him and said, oh, she's not home. And I was like taking a nap in my room. And then I found out he left, and I was like, Dad, why'd you tell him I wasn't here? I'm here. He's like, I don't like the way he walks.
His dad radar.
Yeah.
His dad radar went off. He was like, nope.
But I thought that was stupid when I was a kid. But now that I'm older, I'm like, that was probably a good tip off.
Well, in the course of our research, we found that somebody's gait is highly expressive and it's much harder to hide than your facial expression. We're not trained so much to hide it. You can tell how happy or sad, energized, how tense somebody is just based on their gait. And now they're training computers to look for that.
Yay.
One place I think it's great to know your body language is when you're buying a car. You should know when you're being hustled, hurried. You should know when you're being seduced to spend money on a piece of crap. Because just when you really think about any car, it's really a bad investment. It's just how bad of an investment is it? Their whole thing depends on talking you into signing on the dotted line, closing the deal, which is another reason you might want to have a knowledge of body language so you can be the one selling the car and closing the deal.
Poker face is a term that's used in gambling. Is sometimes people will lie, but there are body language tells that can show you that they're actually lying, so you could probably win the round.
I watched this former FBI interrogator do a body language analysis on a poker game, and it was f***ing amazing.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
Now, I heard tale from my stepdad that he knew was a guy that could always win at Texas Hold'em even when he never looked at his own cards, just by watching the reactions of the others around him and betting appropriately. I believe it.
I wouldn't doubt that.
That's what the real game is.
Also, knowing body language can help you avoid pickup artists, if that's one of your goals in life.
Hell yeah.
Or keep you from making a fool of yourself.
Yeah, like chasing somebody who's not interested, clearly, because you can't read body language correctly. Let's say you're a manager. Let's say you have people that work under you. It can help you command authority and attention. So being heard at your job, selling a product, delegating work to others, public speaking at important events like a funeral, somebody's got to talk. If you're a teacher, or putting on a performance or a show.
I think that there's a certain degree of body language that they teach in Toastmasters too. And they teach you like how to do public speaking and all that kind of stuff.
I really think that the commanding authority and attention aspect of body language is extremely important for people that don't have firm boundaries either, because the whole idea of forming boundaries is mostly based in the way that you poise your body. Like you can say, no, no, don't do that. But if you're like cowering and not standing your ground, so to speak, it can come off as like, go ahead and hurt me because I'm submitting to you. You know, you see animals fight, they bow up, they bristle their fur, and they show their teeth, like, and they try to look as big as possible. Part of having boundaries is standing up, puffing your chest out, and making a physical boundary with your body language. I think that's really powerful to learn.
I've personally had a lot of issues with this in the past, like being in a managerial position and not knowing how to like I'm good at my job, I'm good at like organizing all of this stuff, but I don't know how to delegate work to others and have them respect it, because I would, at that point in time in my life, I was very like soft-spoken.
Yeah. Too polite.
Yeah. And not, I wouldn't command authority and attention. I'd be like, this is your job. And like, this is obviously what you have to do. But I wouldn't know how to like relate that without sounding like an asshole.
Or a bitch. Like, yeah. I get that a lot. If you're not good at that, it's very advisable to practice it. Public speaking aside and entertainment aside, it's really important to actually voice your feelings in a strong way, because then people will not respect them if you're soft-spoken or you're too polite. I've struggled with that as well. So
like body language can teach you not just about what's going on with other people, like learning about body language, but it can also teach you how you're projecting yourself, understanding what you're projecting to other people.
Which brings us to a big point of this episode. The body doesn't lie. There are 7 universally recognized facial expressions: joy, surprise, contempt, sadness, anger, disgust, and fear. I noticed there were more negative ones than positive ones, probably for evolutionary purposes.
Yeah.
I have a fun fact that contempt is the only asymmetrical expression that we make.
Fascinating.
Naturally. Yeah. Like, you know, one side of your nose or one side of your mouth might go off. That's true contempt. And even if you're trying to express something else, you can see, because it makes itself known with an asymmetrical. It's the only one that does that. I think it's like really interesting.
Is it like a sneer?
It's like a one-sided, yeah, and it can happen anywhere, like up from your nose down to your mouth or around your mouth. It's a one-sided, like, ugh.
So if you're talking about the victim and you keep pulling that micro expression, you probably killed that person. Likewise, many of these reactions occur automatically, and they have evolutionary purpose to them. For instance, our response to fear can largely be explained by our fight-or-flight response. When presented with either real or imagined danger, our bodies produce adrenaline, which causes blood flow to increase to our extremities, enabling us to stand, run, or fight quicker. Breathing and heart rate increase to accommodate an anticipated sudden use of energy. Our eyes enlarge in order to take in more information from our surroundings and help us detect threats even better. Squinting eyes of anger correlate with a narrowing of vision upon prey, while baring teeth, shouting, and appearing larger are characteristic primate intimidation techniques honed by millions of years of evolution. Crying alerts our parents to help us. Even the wrinkling of our nose when we're disgusted has the effect of pinching circulation in such a way to dampen the effect of smell on our senses.
I think that's fascinating.
Oh, like if you smell something bad, you'll have a disgust response, so you don't have to smell it as much.
I think it's so cool that there's an actual biological link to why we do that.
Yeah, so each of those faces, there's a reason we do it, which supports the idea that our language is ultimately derived from the limited set of verbs that our bodies are able to produce or participate in, I should say.
Oh, that makes sense too, because if you show your teeth, that's usually a sign of aggression. Have you ever seen somebody smile and they just show all their teeth? It's like they're very, very, very aggressively nice. But if you just smile and you don't show your teeth, then you're just softly nice.
Well, okay, so this idea is based on the concept that our physical bodies have a limited number of actions they can do, a limited number of verbs they can express. And so our language is mostly remixes and colorful combinations of these basic verbs that are built into our body, meaning that our language ultimately rose out of the soup that is our primal body.
That's really interesting because, like, when you speak and you're trying to figure out what it is that you want to say, your brain is focusing so much on that. The more that it focuses on that, the less control it has over the expressions that it's showing. And that's one of the main things that interrogators look for, because when, you know, they're interrogating people, that person is focusing so much on what they're saying back that their brain is overloaded. So these micro expressions come through.
Does anyone know why we get goosebumps? I thought it was to keep us warm.
It can serve for that, but it happens when tiny muscles in our skin's hair follicles, called aerator pili muscles, they pull your hair upright. If you ever heard about somebody saying, oh, my hair was standing on end during the last movement in that orchestra, music can also create this effect. It almost feels cold, but at the same time, if you thought about if we had full body fur, we would be bristling.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. For animals, it works to keep them warm. Us humans, it doesn't actually work to keep us warm.
Mm. It's like a redundant function that continues to happen.
It still gives us a little bit of like a energy reading on our environment, you know, when we're alert.
Yeah. Maybe it makes us more sensitive.
Is this like when dogs raise their hackles? This is kind of like happening on our arms?
Probably. Something, or when cats bristle when they fuzz out. I mean, a lot of mammals do that anyway, but we don't have body fur, so it would look weird to us because we only have like very fine fur there.
So like it's not just related to like a fear response, though, or a cold response, because you can get goosebumps when you listen to certain music and stuff.
And I think that's a beautiful lead in to what we're going to talk about next. We're going to get into why do we even laugh? Laughing is kind of a weird thing that it doesn't always make sense, because sometimes you'll laugh at stuff that doesn't, it's not really funny. I personally think it's a way to diffuse cognitive dissonance. Like if you run into a wall with your thinking, it's a way to relieve stress and anxiety. But what do you guys think about that?
I read a study at one point that was saying that laughter was connected to feelings of safety or wanting feelings of safety in primates, and that it's a leftover trait for us as humans that we laugh at things that like aren't really that funny. Like when other people hurt themselves, we're safe, and so we laugh. Or if we run into a wall and that, like you were saying, and then we laugh afterwards, that laughter is like us being like, oh, we're safe.
You diffuse that, basically running into a problem.
Yeah.
And you can't find a solution to it, or you see that there's like hurt or anguish. Laughter is a way to disperse the anxiety that comes with that problem.
The study that I was reading, I'll see if I can try and find it again to post it in the notes, but it was talking a lot about inappropriate laughter, people who laugh inappropriately, especially when they're nervous. And this is like a self-soothing thing that they don't have control over. Like, they're trying to make themselves feel safe, but it's a very inappropriate spot for it to be acted out, right?
Nervous laughter.
Expressed, yeah. Yeah, so they're trying to give some sort of like, I'm safe, like self-soothing thing to themselves without knowing that that's what they're doing. And that's why nervous laughter happens. And have you ever noticed if you find something funny and you laugh at it and then you realize very much so that was inappropriate because somebody was hurt by that, your laughter stops immediately.
Because right? It's not acceptable.
And you also just went into a kind of pack situation where you're no longer safe because you just upset someone else in the pack.
I think a famous example of this is rest in peace, Ray Liotta, when he gets questioned by Joe Pesci in Goodfellas. You think I'm funny? What's so funny about my story? You know what I mean? And then he goes from like horrified back to like laughing hysterically.
You know, when some people have condescending laughter, like you say something and they just laugh at you in a very condescending way. This is like, I'm safe and I can laugh at you because I'm so confident. That's the underlying subconscious reason as to why they do that.
But you mentioned it as a pack operation as well, mm-hmm. which what if the whole pack is laughing? Then you can't stop laughing. Yeah, and it starts to hurt after a while.
But that condescending laughter also, like if you think about it from a pack kind of sense, when someone has that kind of condescending laughter to you, that's like really diminishing whatever it is that you're saying to them. That's mm-hmm. also like an expression of like, I feel safe and I don't care that you're not part of my pack. Like,
and perhaps they're trying to get other people to laugh at you in tandem with them. So it's a way to gain social favor by, you know, and this also leads me into thinking like, what about people that are class clowns? Like, what about people that want to elicit laughter from the pack members to feel more, you know, ingrained into the social status of the pack?
Like, have you ever had it where, you know, someone says something mean to you and they laugh at it and then, you know, maybe a friend of yours laughs with them. And then afterwards, you're like, why did you laugh with them? That really hurt me. It's because they want to feel like they're part of that pack on a subconscious level. So they laugh with the person who's laughing, right?
Right. Or to not draw attention to themselves if they don't.
Yeah. Like how monkeys, they all laugh and show their teeth together as like kind of this pack behavior.
It reminds me of how I'm thinking like the weirdest times that I laugh, I don't do roller coasters well. I'll probably black out like if I'm on a serious one. But one way I can get around it is if I force myself to laugh and just let the fucking giggles hit through my body because my body feels weird. So it's like I have to just start laughing about it.
You're like reassuring yourself that you're safe.
Yeah. And sometimes even in like meditation or ritual, like when I'm going new places and stuff, very like chaos magician, like I'll sometimes just fucking start laughing hysterically at whatever I'm confronting, you know, in my mind, but it comes out.
Yeah. Dude, when you're on the roller coaster, just pretend like you're pinching a loaf, dude.
That's going to make me laugh.
Fighter pilots have to do that. You have to go,
dude, Malachor, you just hit on something. I do that too, and I never realized, but when I go on theme rides that I'm kind of afraid to be on, I end up just laughing and screaming the whole time. It's so
fun. It feels better.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can laugh at the absurdity of something as well. Let's say like you're in an argument or something, and someone might laugh at something that they think is an absurd statement. So that's them laughing like there's no way that that's true. And I'm laughing at the absurdity of it. And sometimes it's really hard to distinguish if it's that kind of laughter or a condescending laughter.
Yeah.
So it can get you in trouble if you are like laughing at the absurdity of a statement because you're like, there's no way that that's true. And then you laugh at it. Because you feel safe that it's not true, it can also translate like you're just being condescending.
Yeah, being in trouble is a funny feeling too. Like when you know, like especially when you're a kid, I feel like that's a strong gut feeling. It's just like your whole system starts going all weird and you're like, oh, what's going on? Oh, no, I'm going to get caught, ain't I? Like part of realization, you know, when our thoughts start messing with our body down to the stomach level, I think that's very like deep and like immediate.
Yeah, so what is a gut feeling?
I mean, it's something that comes out of the center of your body, I'd say, that's in your gut, like your stomach area. And there's also scientific conjecture that there is a second brain. It's basically the membrane that surrounds our inner guts or the organs. And it moves around and reacts depending on how our brain is processing things.
It also sends messages to our brain.
And it's directly related to the flora in our gut.
There's, I believe it's both your guts, like your stomach specifically, and your heart do send a lot of information to your brain as well. So they kind of have their own thinking, you could say, that happens, and they tell your brain things. So
it's like the subconscious brain. And I really think that that's where a lot of these feelings come from. The gut feeling is your intuition and your subconscious telling you something.
And guts do produce a lot of hormones as well and metabolize hormones. So
yeah, I think a lot of your dopamine and serotonin is stored there too.
Yeah, I'd have to double check. I know that there's hormones that have relationships to our emotions that either are or are metabolized specifically by our guts.
Cortisol is one, which is the stress hormone.
So you definitely have like those gut feelings. There is some scientific backing to your guts being like a kind of brain, a second brain, if you will.
Now, most of these things we discussed fall under the category of the autonomic nervous system, or as some people will call it, the vegetative nervous system, which is what operates smooth muscles and glands. Mostly it's responsible for the function of our internal organs, though. The autonomic nervous system is a control system that acts largely unconsciously, and it regulates body functions such as the heart rate, digestion, respiratory rate, pupillary response, urination, and of course, sexual arousal. The autonomic nervous system is actually divided into three parts, almost like fire and water, with the first two complementing and inhibiting each other. The first is the sympathetic nervous system, which is more closely associated with excitement and is responsible for a fight or flight response. It is currently thought of as a quick response mobilizing system, but even this is merely accurate most of the time. The second system is the parasympathetic nervous system, which is regarded as a more slowly activated dampening system, and it rules over the rest and digest, feed and breed section of the autonomic nervous system. Interestingly, arousal and orgasm require the participation of both systems. The third system of the ANS, the enteric system, is influenced by the other two, but is capable of functioning independently of both of them. This is what you were talking about when you used the term second brain. It's the enteric nervous system.
Oh, it's like almost a compounding of all of these systems. It's like the backup system that switches on.
It works by listening to the others, but it can work completely independently of the others too.
A lot of these responses of the gut, when you have a gut response to something, it feels like you're being possessed and controlled by another entity. I mean, really.
I'd say this is very similar to what an archangel is in the body of God, and that it has angels under it, or demons, archdemon. Those are the little organs, and then it has this bigger brain, and then that is connected to God.
So this enteric nervous system, it can function even when it's cut off from the brain and spinal cord completely.
So question, mm-hmm. Have you heard of these operations they've done where they sever the corpus callosum in the brain, which connects the two hemispheres? Okay, whatever your non-dominant hand is, begins to do things and you're not aware of what it's doing and it has a mind of its own, quote unquote. That would be
titty.
Direct. Yeah. Or patients have reported they were putting on their clothes in the morning and then their left hand would knock away the clothes or unbutton them again and stuff like that and go and grab like garish looking things that don't match or like whatever the hell it wanted to grab.
This sounds like real life Evil Dead.
Kind of, but it's weird because if you sever the two brain hemispheres, apparently your whole left side or right side, depending on how you're dominant, starts to act like a completely different entity. And it might just be the enteric nervous system acting out because it doesn't have words. It just kind of does stuff.
Scary.
So you're saying Evil Dead is a true story.
Maybe their brains are shut off, but the body still does something and it still has, you know, it still can think and do actions.
Idle hands are the devil's plaything.
Yeah.
That was the other movie I was thinking of.
Honestly, it reminds me of Ouija boards. Like, is that what the spirits take over?
Probably.
We'll talk about that in the extended show. Do our hearts think?
Yes.
I feel like the heart is just as metaphysical and mysterious to us now as it was ancient people. If you ask the internet what modern science believes, they'll tell you the heart's a pump. It's governed by the autonomic nervous system and has 40,000 or so neurons attached to it that basically just help it pump. It doesn't think about your grandma. That's all it does. But
okay,
But oh yeah, since the 1800s, we've known that more signals are sent from the heart to the brain than the other way around. So it leads some to speculate. Does the heart think?
That was the other organ that was said to send a lot of signals to the brain, aside from your guts.
There's a cool thing that happens inside of our heart when the blood goes through certain valves. It actually kind of has the same symmetries as a black hole shooting out the light through its poles. Like fluid movement will do that. And inside our heart, there is a valve that kind of mimics. It's like a little mini black hole of blood that occurs.
Well,
this is so cool.
Well, one particularly interesting rabbit hole worth exploring is the idea that the heart might not be a pump at all. Dan Barber in The Third Plate re-explores the writings of turn of the century occultist Rudolf Steiner, who at one point in his life would lead the German branch of the Theosophical Society. Take that how you will. Steiner says, in order for human beings to improve and make true progress, they need to understand that the heart is not a pump, Barber explains. For one thing, when blood enters the heart, it's traveling at the same speed as when it exits. It slows down as it heads to the smaller capillaries to transfer nutrients, then moves to the venous system, a highway of larger and larger veins that eventually lead back to the heart. As it approaches, the blood speeds up again. The heart acts more like a dam at this point, trapping the blood and holding it in chambers until they're filled. This means that the heart functions more like a dam or a fluid break. According to Steiner, the heart's primary role is the circulation of blood. Through its rhythmic pulsations, its systole and its diastole, the heart responds to what takes place in the circulation of the blood. It's the blood that drives the heart, not the other way around. So the heart doesn't pump the blood pumps the heart.
I like to think of it as like a regulator.
Well, that makes sense too, because if you're healthy, then you have a low heart rate per minute, and it's lower because your blood pressure must be low. The dam isn't filling up as quickly. It's not driving, the beating is not having to be as hard or often, because you have a nice slow flow and it's going the right rate.
Well, I'm not going to bend over backwards to try and find any hard science that backs this up. Some people speculate that the intense rhythmic capacity of the heart and its magnetic field helps coordinate multiple systems at once.
It has an electromagnetic field.
It's kind of where the center of your energy field is located. Yeah, your heart or your solar plexus is the center.
I think I got a black hole in my heart.
Mine's upside down.
Whoa.
So basically, it's like when your body needs to do some mixing, it looks to your heart as its BPM to like mix in and out certain tracks. That's basically what it's saying.
Ah, okay. So it could mess up other systems if your heart is unhealthy.
Well, your heart's trying to like compensate, and it's trying to like bind all the systems into one harmonious rhythm. So if your heart's acting all crazy, it's because it's struggling to do that.
Oh, not the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. So if the body never lies, are empaths just using their body?
Yes.
Do you guys know about cold readers?
Yeah, I've seen them before, and some of them are shams, but there's a couple that I've seen that are actually extremely talented.
Cold readers is referring specifically to when someone is reading your body language and giving you a reading, like a tarot reading or a psychic reading, based specifically off of the physical evidence, the cold reading of your expressions, your gestures, in combination with what you're saying. So this does occur. Obviously, not all tarot readers or psychics do this, but it is something that does happen. And I do think that this actually does have a connection with what you could call your sixth sense. I do think it's the same thing that empathic people pick up on. It's just that the cold readers do this consciously and know why and how to read, whereas the empaths might not know the conscious reasoning for why they pick up on it.
That's an excellent synopsis of that, because a lot of these people, like I said before, I know some that most of them are con artists and they use body language reading. They get really good at their practice. And what they also do is study statistics and patterns analysis. And so they can kind of look at somebody and they take in a lot of other things, not just body language. They take in, what are they wearing? Who are they with? What are they talking about? How do they, you know, it's all of this stuff compounded on one another. And this is also what aggressive salesmen use.
Yep.
Or con artists, people that are trying to scam you. Insurance companies use this kind of tactic. So it's, you're consciously, you have a goal in mind and you're trying to consciously bet on the future of somebody's actions. However, empaths and the sixth sense, like you were talking about, by contrast, maybe you might be subconsciously aware or aware in the gut of these patterns, but you're not necessarily consciously having a goal in mind. You're just reading the person outright because you're fine-tuned into looking at these small, subtle inflections in body language and tone of voice and all these other things.
You know that you're picking up on something, but you might not know why, whereas people who do cold reading typically do know why. They know they're consciously reading you.
And a lot of empaths also report the feeling of feeling the other person's emotions and thoughts themselves, which is you're translating the thoughts so efficiently that you're confused about your own feelings. So that can be a problem.
When we talk about people using it on purpose, this brings us right into the police. So as long as been systematizing people's body language and trying to understand it, the people that have inherited that destiny are essentially the FBI, the police, etc. And they do a really smart thing of breaking things down into nonverbal cues and nonverbal clusters. A nonverbal cue is if you broke down all the signals a person could make and divided it up into individual parts or units. For instance, the batting of eyelashes is one nonverbal cue, and biting your lips is another. When they appear together, we say that they're a cluster. Defining nonverbal cues versus clusters are important because, in the case of the last two examples, they can be interpreted as seductive or inviting together. But maybe with a cluster of other cues, they could mean a number of other things.
Like looking away from the person talking to you and batting your eyelashes might mean that you're lying.
Or you have something stuck in your eye, even.
This is why it's so important to understand clusters, because there is no singular action that can tell you for certain whether someone is lying or not, whether someone feels this or not. We're such complicated animals that these clusters are important to understanding the bigger picture, because we do so many different things and there's so many different signals that we do, no matter what emotion you're feeling, what words you're saying. So yeah, it takes usually a cluster to determine probability, not certainty, but probability, likelihood.
So how can you tell if somebody is lying?
There's no one thing. Universal symptoms are non-existent in lie detection. So there's a lot of misconceptions out there. People think, oh, you look to this side, that means you're lying. Or, oh, this happened, that means you're lying. And even polygraphs aren't reliable. And this is because there are no universal symptoms in relation to lie detection. And we do have, as individuals, we do have baseline variants. This is the technical term for it, is a baseline. So this is how we act outside of stressful situation, how we normally act inside of a stressful situation. Our actions prior to a question regarding something in an interrogation, our baseline behavior sets a standard for us. So this is why they'll usually try and establish a baseline before jumping in.
Like talk personal life and do you like this band? What do you like to eat for dinner? Like that kind of conversation.
Yeah. And even asking questions that aren't directly related at first to see, like, does this question cause them any kind of anxiety? Even if it's not like them straight up asking, like, did you kill her? You know, just being like, well, tell me about your relationship with your mother and see if there's any baseline nervousness that comes across, like,
or
this
anger,
is
even.
It's a very complicated ordeal with interrogations, and a lot of training goes into it for these people to understand how even to establish baseline variants. That is relative to every single individual. So universal symptoms, they do exist for emotions, but they don't exist regarding a lie. That's what makes it so difficult. So we rely on these deceptive clusters, and the clusters are the actions or the expressions, and they happen close together. So the more symptoms of deception are clustered together, the higher the probability. And it's just the raising of a higher possibility of a lie. It isn't absolute. Even interrogators can't tell you this is a lie.
But there's a lot of nonverbal clues as well that go on at the same time that they're telling you one thing, but you see another in the way that they behave or their posture.
Yeah. Typically, an interrogator will say, like, I see a cluster of deception regarding this subject. They won't say, like, this person is lying about this subject. It just gives a, you know, an indicator that they need to ask more questions. They need to dive deeper on that subject. So then knowing someone's baseline is really important for knowing what's outside of their baseline so that they can detect these deceptive clusters.
But like, what if someone gets nervous and they start acting, you know, they start trembling and looking away and then they don't know what to say and they're stammering? Like, how do you tell the innocent person from the person that's actually actively lying?
It's very tricky. You need to look at clusters. This person could just be like nervous because they're in a police station and they're being asked questions, and they could be upset for any number of reasons or on guard for any number of reasons.
Right. And interrogation's an interesting scenario because it's like you are in an interrogation room. If you're trying to determine like who did it, while it's happening, like the person who's guilty might be able to play it off because of environmental factors. It just supports your thing that it's hard to determine baseline, you know, indicators of somebody lying or deception.
Yeah. And there could be many reasons for deception aside from lying, like not wanting to face a certain thing or a subject that makes someone uncomfortable. But I can give you examples, like symptomatic examples of cluster behavior that when you find them together, it's a higher probability of deception.
Yeah.
So do you guys know what the Pinocchio effect is?
The more you lie, your nose gets bigger.
When you get a boner.
So the Pinocchio effect is something that happens when you have to engage a lot of thought, when you're trying to figure things out, like when people are trying to come up with a story, that when their brain is working overtime, the heat increases in your face because you need more blood to rush into that area. One of the side effects of that is called the Pinocchio effect. So it means that your nose tends to heat up and sometimes it gets itchy or people feel more inclined to touch their nose or their face.
Yeah.
It's obviously not a single symptom like anything. It doesn't tell you that someone's lying, but it does tell you that they're more stressed and are having to think a lot more.
I knew of one tell that if somebody looks upward while they're recollecting something, it's almost like they're looking inside of their head to remember the actual event. Whereas any other eye motion or scratching your nose or face, like the Pinocchio effect, wouldn't tell that maybe they're not recollecting something, but they're constructing something.
Well, it depends. It also really depends on their baseline. People look into different directions when they're trying to recall something. It depends too. If they're accessing an intellectual aspect, like words, they might look up. People also look up to keep themselves from crying. If you feel like you might start crying, you tend to like look up to try and dry your eyes. When you look down, that's the emotional realm you're usually internalizing. So it's either internal dialogue or internal emotions. It could be accessing a memory that's emotional, or it could be an emotion that has to do with the fact that you don't want to talk about this. So there's so many different things that we do. And it's really hard to know without knowing that person's baseline what that's indicative of.
Ah.
So like saying you look in this direction and that's a lie. It's
but
not.
What if they always look in either direction? If that's their baseline, then that's probably not a lie.
Yeah. So another thing is contractions. A lot of times when you're speaking naturally, you'll use contractions with verbs. So you would say I didn't instead of I did not.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
That's a good example. That's a very good example.
It's a great one.
Using contractions is a more natural way of saying something, whereas the lack of contractions is more of a, I'm trying to say this thing. People tend to drop contractions if they're being asked repetitively about something. Like you will drop contractions naturally if you're adamant about getting the point across as well. So it's not an indicator specifically of a lie. You know, if someone keeps asking you and asking you and asking you if you did something, eventually you're going to be like, I did not, right? So it's, again, just one of the cluster things. There's a difference between emphasis of point for deception and defense. when we emphasize our point, we tend to, you know, lean forward into it. We tend to have synchronized movements with our hands. If our hands are not synchronized with what we're saying, it's our brain might be overloaded with a narrative that we're trying to put across. Some people say detailed accounts of any incidents. If there's too much information, it might be a made-up story. But again, in a traumatic situation, we might have certain things that stick with us, and we don't know why it sticks with us. And it's just only one symptom of a cluster. Sometimes it just comes down to the baseline. Sometimes you offer more information in a true story because you think it might not be as believable, right? So even in a true story, you might offer more information if you think it's going to be hard to believe.
I mean, I had someone panhandle me at a gas station once, and she was down on her luck or whatever and came up. You know how they come up to you at the pump and they're like, hey, do you have any money? Can I have some money? And I was like, nah, I don't. I went in the store, came back with my Gatorade and whatever, and she was crying with her head on the steering wheel and her door open. She needed gas to get out of an abusive relationship. And that's when I bought her a tank of gas. Like, only until I saw that with no one around and she was acting that way, I was like, okay, that's a real one.
Yeah, it wasn't until you felt that in her body language, right?
Gotcha. But there was no one there to watch her. Yeah. I just had walked out and seen that after I told her I don't have money.
So I'm just going to list off a bunch of things that together can make a cluster that heightens the probability of deception. Mouth covering, eye blocking, self-soothing or grooming actions, word salad, that's stumbling over your words or not being able to get something out, high blink rate, someone's posture, contractions, offset defining gestures, like I was saying, offbeat movements like slapping or motioning, putting too much detail to the theme of the story than what's necessary. Duper's delight is another one, whether that's an inappropriate smile or a smirk. Qualifying statements like honestly, or I am a good person, like trying to convince their convincing statements, emoting expressions that don't match or sync appropriately, you know, engaging, this would be like engaging frustration muscles in your forehead in an attempt to emulate grief where those muscles wouldn't actually be engaged, or using softening language referring to actions or distancing statements to actions or persons involved, acting unnecessarily defensive or aggressive to non-accusational questions, time-buying statements like repeating the question, like when they ask a question and then the other person says, what do you mean by that? In response, that's a time-buying question so that their brain can think of something to say. Or unnecessary or exaggerated gestures. So all of these can contribute to a cluster. If they happen close together, then there's a higher probability of deception. If it's outside of their baseline.
Duper's delight is straight up spooky.
Yeah, that it's like a smile or a smirk when they think that they've gotten away with it, and it's not always a conscious thing.
It looks really out of place and like malicious and scary. It's creepy. Also, if somebody is explaining something exceptionally traumatic, they should have word salad. And if they suddenly don't have word salad and what they're saying becomes like very controlled and like thought out, then there's probably a problem.
Yeah, unless it's such a traumatic situation and the way that they've dealt with it is by disassociation, then they might be a little bit more clear. I know that that's definitely a behavior to disassociate, to distance yourself that way. You can get a lot of false positives from this too. Like deception symptoms can occur for multiple reasons beyond lying. We just tend to show deceptive indicators even when we don't want to face something.
Yeah, maybe you haven't processed that trauma yet, and perhaps the question has thrown you into that process all of a sudden. Like for me, for example, I would freeze. I would lock down and become unresponsive if the stress was high enough. Some people will do that. Some others won't. It depends on their history as well.
Yeah, this is why baselines and clusters are so important. It's not just in relation to deception. It's in relation to literally every emotion or every situational thing. We have clusters for different things. This just happens naturally with us. And it's also not a flat out lie. When that happens, it doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't deception. This is why they specify in court the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So that the truth would be a lie. The whole truth would be the whole story that goes with the lie, everything related to that. And nothing but the truth means you're not elaborating on it, because elaboration or
misdirection
would be something other than the truth. So the nothing but the truth covers that. That's why they say that in court.
So it's like a magic thing.
Dude, stage magicians totally use the reading of body language for people. That's why they're good at what they do. They know if I show you this, you will think this.
And then you won't be looking over here.
Yes.
Or over here at www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your donation of just $5 gets you access to all our extended episodes, including this one, a 5x5 high quality vinyl sticker of our cover art, and access to our Discord server, where you can talk to us anytime, day or night, about what a great liar you are. Thank you, everybody. My autonomic nervous system is forcing me to eat carrots and shoot lasers.